And so we began last week looking at the hidden treasures of the kingdom. And we're going to continue that this week, Matthew chapter 13. We're going to try to cover verses 45 through 52. That's what I had slated for last week, and I got through all of one verse. But I did happen to check as I was transferring that audio file to our website, and I noticed that it was only 30 minutes long. I didn't preach necessarily long last week, so I'm not sure what happened. We had communion, and I think we had some other things before the preaching time. So I don't think I was too long-winded. And this is where you all say, no, Pastor, no, you weren't long-winded at all. Okay? So we're going to try to cover those next few verses this morning as we continue on looking at this hidden treasure of the kingdom. So verse 44 talks to us about a man who's walking through a field and trips over a treasure. In other words, he's not quite looking for it, but there it is. And as soon as he sees it, he recognizes that it is valuable. So he goes out, sells all that he has, purchases the field, and acquires the treasure. It's the story of a man who unknowingly, he wasn't, as we said, looking for this treasure, but he found it and he recognized what it was. And it's descriptive for us of some folks that see the kingdom for the first time and immediately recognize what it is, but they weren't necessarily seeking for it. There's a lot of talk these days about seekers and people that are searching for the kingdom of God, they're searching for truth. And this parable isn't talking about that. These are people that weren't looking for it, but it found them. Now, understand that these parables are not dealing with the specifics of God's sovereign control over salvation. They're simply presenting these parables to highlight for us different aspects of the kingdom. And that is, some people don't appear to be looking for it, but it finds them. This is my story as a young man. I was not necessarily looking for anything. In fact, I was heading the other direction and getting into some trouble. And I look at my life and say, I wasn't in serious trouble. You know, we hear stories of people that give us their testimonies, and they were drug addicts, and they were criminals and murderers, and the Lord saved them. I say, well, yeah, my story's not all that impressive. I like to tell it, because it's pertinent to me. I know what God did in my life. And that's what I think is amazing. Sometimes we glorify the sin people were in beforehand, so that I'm really stumbling over this word, aren't I? Because it's a really dramatic story. The change is dramatic, but the grace of God that extends to the four-year-old who gets saved and never enters into a life of sin and rebellion is just as amazing as the grace of God extended to the murderer or the drug addict. God's grace is amazing stuff. But this was sort of my story. I wasn't really looking for it. I've been taught a little bit about heaven and Jesus as a kid. We went to church, but they didn't preach the gospel. And so as a young 14-year-old, when this college student began sharing the gospel with me and taking me to church each Sunday, and I was hearing the gospel message, I hadn't been looking for it ahead of time. But there it was. God began to impress upon my life this thing you've tripped over in the middle of the field. It's valuable. And I began to realize it until that one night as he took me out for ice cream and shared the gospel with me again. The light came on, the Holy Spirit opened my mind and my heart to understand it. And I sold everything else, just like the man did with the field. I said, this is it. This is what life's about. Everything's got to revolve around this, as we talked about last week. So as he gets into verse 44, he's sharing the concept that this is a hidden kingdom. It's not patently obvious to everybody, because many people walk by the field and never notice the treasure, but only those who trip on it, as it were, recognize it. Verse 45 and 46, he's going to present a slightly different aspect, and it's going to remind us that this is a treasure worth getting. These are very similar parables, because they're going to highlight some similar aspects of the kingdom, but the difference is in the emphasis that's placed. So again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls, who on finding one pearl of great value went and sold all that he had and bought it. So some similar aspects of this are that the man finds a treasure and sells everything he's got in order to acquire it. And again, we emphasized last week, this is not about purchasing salvation. If you're interested in purchasing salvation, we're going to have to tell you a different message. No amount of money that you put into the offering plate will purchase your forgiveness of sins. We won't stop you from putting money in the offering plate. But if you're doing it for that reason, we will stop you and say no, not for that. Because Jesus offers salvation freely to you. It's yours to be had by asking and saying, Lord, I recognize that you died for my sins, and there's nothing I can do to secure forgiveness of my own sins. You did it all. So this isn't about purchasing salvation. This is about the value of the kingdom. So this kingdom of heaven is like a merchant. Now I want you to notice something about this merchant. He's searching for it. He's out looking for it. He knows there's a treasure out there. As Kim and I go to auctions, and I know Dan was at the auctions yesterday, and Don and Tom were there, and it's just a lot of fun to look through all those old boxes because you just never know what you're going to find, and sometimes you find a treasure. You find a little thing that maybe got thrown into a box and other people didn't recognize, and that's sort of what you live for going to those auctions. You can buy a box full of stuff for a dollar and find something in there that's valuable, something that's worth something. A lot of times I go looking for stuff to hang on my wall of old tools. Many of you have seen that wall. And so I'm kind of on the lookout for old tools. And when I see them, I really hope they're going to go for not much because I'm cheap. And I don't want to pay a lot of money, but I want to have cool stuff, right? So this merchant is in search of things, and he's searching for fine pearls. I found this as just an interesting little tidbit. Doesn't advance our understanding of the passage much, but the word for pearls in Greek is margaritas. Not the little drink with an umbrella in it, right? But the name, Margaret, comes from this Greek word. If your name is Margaret, then you're a pearl. You're a pearl. And so this merchant is searching for pearls of great price, pearls of great value, pearls that are very, very valuable. And so he is going out looking for them, and he sorts through the pearls, and he casts aside the ones that are small or ill-shaped or odd-colored, and he deems them unvaluable. But he's looking for fine pearls. Now, I would probably, searching for pearls, not know the difference between this little thing and this one. Now, you all are sitting a little bit farther away, so maybe you can't discern the difference. And I'm sure that some of you, if I would hold these up close, would know which is which. Can you tell? Okay. They're both white. They're both small. They're both round. How would you know if one's valuable or not? Well, if you're a dealer in fine pearls, you know the difference, don't you? You're looking for the difference. So, all right, you know how to tell a pearl. Rub it on your teeth. If it's rough, it's a real pearl. If it's smooth, it's not a real pearl. Of course, we know how to manufacture these things. This happens to be a real pearl. This happens to be the little plastic marble out of our Hungry Hungry Hippos game. One is valuable. The other's not. And so later on today, when I see Peter playing Hungry Hungry Hippos, and this one, is the pearl is in there, I'll know I got them mixed up and didn't put it back where it belonged, right? So, how do you know the difference? Well, this man's looking for it. He's searching it, so he is able to discern between what is valuable and what isn't valuable. And so, when he encounters this pearl of great value, what does he do with it? He sells everything he's got. He went and sold all that he had, and he bought it. It sounds like such a short description. It sounds like it's very much the same as in verse 44. We highlighted there the notation that man was joyful when he found the kingdom buried in the field. The kingdom is the source of all joy in life, all real joy, not what is fake. But this jeweler who is looking for the pearl recognizes its value, recognizes everything else has got to be subservient to that. He's got to have that pearl. And so he sells off everything he's got, and he goes and he buys that pearl because he obviously deems that that pearl is worth more than everything he owns. Now the distinction between these two parables is in the emphasis and the descriptions. And some of this doesn't come out as much in our English translations as you can see it in the original Greek. And I always wrestle with how much you point out about this, because I don't ever want anyone to think that our English translations are not sufficient. They are. But there are some details that just simply don't come across in English. There is, in Greek, here's your Greek lesson for the day, so you can impress all your friends around the water cooler at work this week. Here's your Greek lesson of the day. There exists, in the Greek, a verb tense called the perfect. We have a perfect tense in English. They are nothing the same. So we can't confuse a perfect English with a perfect Greek tense. The Greek tense in the perfect communicates an action that was finished in the past, but which has results that continue into the future. Does that make sense? An action that was completed in the past, but has results that continue into the future, or at least to the present time of the speaker. Context tells you how far those results carry. So Jesus, when he's hanging on the cross, makes a very emphatic statement and says, "It is finished." That is in the perfect tense. It's done. It's an action that's completed, and the results of which will continue. Actually, the exact phrasing that Jesus used, the Greek word tetelestai, is found on receipts. You know, they used to scribble receipts on pottery and on pieces of parchment, and they'd throw them away. Well, we find these in their garbage dumps. And it was the word, the exact word, that they would stamp on things when it was paid in full. So Jesus saying, "It is finished," is making a statement. It is paid for. It's done. You're never going to get another notice in the mail that says, "You're past due. Please send us a check." It's been finished. The description of this man, he went and sold everything that he has, is put in the perfect tense. And so the description becomes very, very vivid. That he didn't just sell everything, he sold it. It's the difference between what you put out at a garage sale to sell and when you sell your home. You know, the stuff you put out at your garage sale, you didn't really want it, did you? That's all the stuff that's been cluttering your house. And you say, let's just get rid of it. I'm tired of the clutter. Let's sell some of this stuff off. And I don't even care if I make much money on it. I just want to get rid of it. But you sell your home, and that's a life-altering event, isn't it? You've got to find a new place to go. Hopefully you've already found one. But you will not be in that house again. You've sold it. And that's the distinction that's being made here. In the first parable of the treasure hidden in the field, the hidden treasure is stated in the perfect tense. It's a treasure that had been hidden. There's implications for that. God has concealed it. He hasn't made it easy to find. But in this parable, the picturesque descriptive language is used of the man selling everything he's got. Why does Jesus do that? Because the point of this parable is to emphasize and intensify the cost. Jesus has already told us what it takes to follow him. That if you're not willing to take up your cross and deny yourself and follow him, you can't be his disciple. Why is that important? Why does he draw that out in this parable? Because we understand about selling things. We understand what that feels like to get rid of something that we cling to. We have a process in our house called Mount Vernoning. We've been doing this for a year, where once a year you start in one room and you just start making your way through that room. Every item in the room gets sorted. And you decide, am I going to keep it, am I going to give it away, or am I going to sell it? And so you have to wrestle with, do I need this thing sitting around the house? Have I used it in the last year? Is it of great significance to me? And sometimes you run into something that you say, well, it's kind of significant to me, but I haven't used it in 5 years, so there's no point in having it around. And you got to make those distinctions between what's really significant and what is less significant and what's just hanging around because I thought it was interesting in an auction and I bought it for a dollar and now it's just cluttering up. But the point that Jesus is making in this parable is this man recognized, compared to that pearl, everything else in life was insignificant. Take everything you own. Are you willing to sell it? Are you willing to get rid of it? Now, Jesus isn't just talking about physical stuff here, because we sell ourselves to all manner of things. We deem that many things in life are more significant than they should be, don't we? So we sell ourselves to our careers. Pastors do this as much as anybody. Oh, don't think pastors are immune from this idea of trying to build a big legacy around their churches. Is church growth good? Yeah, it sure it is. Can the pastor be doing it for the wrong reason? You better believe he can. And so sometimes pastors even will try to build themselves and they sell themselves to their career. So then what happens is all decisions begin to revolve around that concept, right? So the man's buying the pearl because everything else revolves around the pearl. What happens if your life isn't revolving around the kingdom? It's revolving around something else, folks. We are worshipers at heart. We have to be worshiping something. And if we're not worshiping the true God, we're worshiping an idol, whatever it is. Whether it's our job, or whether it's our family, or whether it's our... Put it in here. All right? All idols demand sacrifice. So if you're worshiping something that is not the true God, what gets sacrificed? Family? Kids? Time with other people? Money? Sometimes people spend big money to get their name heightened in their career, don't they? I mean, hey, let's face it, that's the big thing with Donald Trump. He's willing to spend his own money to become president. How don't we love that? This man recognized the value of that pearl, and he recognized everything had to revolve around it, and that's the same sort of devotion, dedication, and recognition of the value that we have to place into Christ and His kingdom. It's got to be all of it. It's everything. But the great thing about Christ, the great thing about worshiping the true God, is that it puts everything else in proper perspective. Because when you worship your career, and you sacrifice everything to that career, those things get destroyed. And how often have we seen men, even, again, I'll reference pastors because it's happened, we see pastors whose families have been destroyed because they devoted their life to trying to build a ministry. But when you worship the true God, we recognize everything else falls in its proper place, because does God, if I'm worshiping Him, does He command me in how I am supposed to behave towards my family? Yes, He does. Does He command me in how I'm supposed to be behaving at work? Yes, He does. Does He command me in how I'm supposed to behave towards my neighbors? Yeah, He does. So when I put Him first, all these other peripheral things fall into their proper place. But if I take one of these things and I try to make it the center, then everything else falls to pieces. So this hidden treasure, this pearl of great price, is valuable. It has to be sought out. It's something worth selling everything else for. And that's the distinction that he makes with this pearl of great price. It is a costly treasure. It's a valuable treasure. So verse 44 tells us the treasure is hidden. Verses 45 and 46 tell us the treasure is costly. It's valuable. The next parable, the parable of the net, verses 47 to 50, is going to tell us that this is a mingled treasure, apparently. It appears to be mingled. He says, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was thrown into the sea and gathered fish of every kind. And when it was full, men drew it ashore and they sat down and sorted the good into containers but threw away the bad. So it will be at the close of the age. The angels will come out and separate the evil from the righteous and throw them into the fiery furnace. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. First examination, this seems a parable out of place. All right, we're talking about the necessary devotion to the discipleship of the kingdom, and then all of a sudden we're talking about sorting fish. But it is simply because Jesus is recognizing that in the appearance of the kingdom, there will be those who look like they're on board, but aren't. What did Jesus say? Not everyone that says to me, "Lord, Lord," will enter the kingdom. Because there are plenty of people that claim to be pursuing that pearl. They claim to be selling everything to try and get that pearl, but they're not. Their heart's set on the wrong thing. Their mind's following the wrong path, although it looks like they're on the same path. Okay? And so, while we're pursuing this pearl, while we're trying to buy that treasure in the field, there's other people that look like they're going after it too. And so he gives us this parable. It's like a dragnet. So you understand, fishing then is a little different from what we do now. You get your fishing license, you go up to Lake Mendota, you get your worm and you put it on the hook and you throw the hook in and you sit there and wait a few minutes and, oh, I got a bite and I'm going to reel him in, right? You bring it in and he's this big. You take him off, throw him back, and then you go home and people say, hey, how'd fishing go? Oh, I caught a fish. It was huge. It was this big. It was a monster. The granddaddy of all bluegill that live there in Lake Mendota. Well, catching fish that way for a living wouldn't be very profitable, would it? So if you're going to sell a fish for a few pennies a piece, then you're not going to rack up a whole lot of support money by catching fish one at a time. So they would go out on the Sea of Galilee, and they would take a net, and they would throw it in the water, and it's weighted so that it sinks down into the water and spreads itself out. And then when you're ready, when it's sunk far enough, you pull up on the lines and it kind of closes itself in around the fish and you pull this net out of the water and hopefully you've caught a whole load of fish without using any worms. Right? Because worms are gross. I mean, who likes to actually shove those worms onto the hook? Well, this was a very familiar picture to the disciples because several of them were professional fishermen. They knew what this was all about. They'd done it 100 times. Peter and Andrew, his brother, were fishermen. James and John, it was a family business. So these men knew what fishing was all about. So this picture is very, very clear to them. So he's presenting this picture, and they had, again, done this 100 times. You throw the net out, you pull it back in, and when you pull it in, you're not being selective about what you caught in that net, are you? If you go up to Lake Mendota and you want to fish for bass, you're going to use certain lures. There's certain things you're not going to use because they typically don't catch bass. I'm not a fisherman, so I don't know what those things are. I put my worm on the hook, I throw it in, and I'm happy that anything ever bites. And after about 10 minutes, when I'm bored out of my skull, I go home. Right? My stepdad was an avid fisherman. Had the bass boat, had tackle boxes full of different lures, and I would open the drawers and say, every one of these looks the same to me. What's the point? He said, oh, well, this one catches this kind of fish if it's this weather. And this one, depending on the temperature outside, will catch this kind of fish. So if it's cold and you're hunting for carp, you want this. I mean, does anybody actually fish for carp? But you got to cook them just right to make them taste. You catch carp, Dan? Not too often. So he knew all that stuff, and I had no idea. But you throw the net in, you pull it in, you're going to get all kinds of different fish. So what do? Pull it back to the shore. And the ones that are valuable you can sell, you're going to put a container, you're going to take them to market, and you're going to sell them. The other ones that you can't sell, you're going to throw back. I have a question, it's a life-altering question, that I like to ask people when we're talking about fishing, because I'm still looking for a reasonable answer to this. Who in the world pulled an orange spider off the bottom of the ocean and said, I bet if you boil that thing and dip it in butter, it would taste good? I mean, somebody pulled a crab in for the first time and said, I don't know, I think maybe you could eat that. Instead of just saying, throw it away. Somebody ate it. And it actually tastes good, and we're surprised, right? So here's the picture. You're sitting on the shore, you're sorting out the fish. What's good, what can be sold, what's valuable, what can't? This parable comes with an explanation, unlike the other two parables that we just heard. So you get this explanation, so it will be at the close of the age. When the kingdom has been spread out, it has wrapped up all sorts, it's going to be pulled back in, and they're going to be sorted. So during this phase of the kingdom, which is the church age, sometimes it is difficult to tell who's pursuing the kingdom and who isn't. We do it the best we can. We do it imperfectly, right? But there's coming a time when it will all be sorted out. The angels will come out, separate the evil from the righteous, because this kingdom is valuable, because it is pure. If you're buying treasures like gold and silver, try to make sure that they are genuine, that they're real. The kingdom is a real treasure. But it will be sorted out and its value will appear in its full glory at the end of the age. What's he trying to say? Look, as we're pursuing this treasure right now, during this age of the world and the kingdom is being proclaimed by the church, and we are living as kingdom citizens. Occasionally there are people that come and go. They come, we think they're with us, they sprout up quickly, then they pass away off the scene. For whatever reason, we realize that person wasn't actually with us. But there's coming a day, once that net has been drawn back in and God commands his angels to go out into the world, gather everybody up, there's going to be a sorting so that the full value of the kingdom can be seen. Jesus referenced this back in verse 41 when he's talking about the parable of the weeds. Right now there's weeds growing together. I'm sorry. There's wheat growing alongside the weeds. But there's going to come a day when God is going to send his angels out, gather up all the crops, separate the weeds from the wheat, gather the wheat into the barn, which is the kingdom, and the tares are going to be burned. Same thing here. God's going to send out the angels. They're going to draw in that net, and they're going to start sorting. And those that didn't genuinely believe it are going to be cast into the fiery furnace. Quite literally, the wording there is the lake of fire. Throw them into the fiery furnace, the lake of fire. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I believe we referenced this a couple of weeks ago. But there's a lot of confusion about whether hell is going to be a real and literal place of suffering or whether it's figurative and symbolic. And this is the second time now that the Lord Jesus has used this reference. Because Jesus talked about hell more than he talked about some other topics that we like to talk about. Because it is a very real place. It is a very real danger that those who don't recognize the value of the kingdom, those who aren't willing to sell everything for it, are going to miss it. For those who live in rebellion against God's truth and against God's Son, there awaits for them only the reality of a fiery hell. We proclaim the gospel not because we want to see people burn, but though we recognize that hell is a literal, real place, a place of torment, a place of suffering, a place where it will be fully recognized that you are completely cut off from the love and goodness of God and you'll know Him only in His wrath. And so we proclaim Christ because we love people and do not want them to end up there. And how much hatred could we have for people if we know this and know there's a way of escape but don't tell them? Why? Because we're afraid of what they might say to us? Shouldn't we have more fear of what they might say to the Lord? You say, boy, I lived beside that guy for how many years and he never told me that? Our righteous action has to be followed up with righteous proclamation. Well, he's going to finish up one more. Justin, I'm going to switch this off. For some reason, I'm popping around here. Okay. Are we picking up there? Jesus is going to finish up this section with one more. And he asks them this question, have you understood all these things? And they said to him, yes. See, he's given them several parables, and several of them he explained for them in order to give them examples of how to interpret the parables. So that now when he gives these parables, they say, oh, I get it. I'm with you now. I understand how you're dealing with these things. And so, have you understood all these? And they said to him, yes. They got it. Yes, Lord. And he said to them, therefore, every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who brings out of his treasury what is new and what is old. See, we saw that this is a hidden treasure. Back in verse 44, we saw that it is a costly treasure in 45 and 46. 47 through 50 shows us that it's a mingled treasure, but it will be purified. And here in verse 51 and 52, Jesus is going to tell us this is a treasure to be shared. This is a treasure to be shared. He says, every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom. Now, they understood what scribes were. We use a different term these days. We talk about students. Scribes were the academia of the day. They were the students that spent their time studying a specific subject. Didn't mean that that's what they did for their living, but it meant that that's what they did with a lot of their spare time. So some of you have a job that you do for your living, but you study something else on the side for fun. Something that interests you. Something that just gets your mental fire going and you love looking into it. You're a student of that, right? You're a scribe of that. So every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom, he's giving us the content of what our learning is supposed to be. We're scribes in studying what the kingdom of heaven is like. How do we do that? We read what God's told us. It's not about me sitting around and musing and saying, well, if God were this way, then the kingdom of heaven would look like this. And unfortunately, that's the path a lot of theology takes these days. We start with a premise that we have conjured up in our minds, and then we try and figure out how God's ruling the world according to that premise. And sadly, the reality is God's already told us what he's like and what his kingdom's like. So if I want to be a scribe of the kingdom, then here's my textbook. And we are all of us commanded to be searching this thing, involved in reading it and studying it. Does that mean it occupies all of your time? No. I love in the movie Fiddler on the Roof. How many of you have seen Fiddler on the Roof? Great fun flick, isn't it? Sad. I like to watch the first half and then don't watch the second half because it's depressing. But in the first half, Tavia sings a song, If I Were a Rich Man. And one of the things he says in that song is, I'd spend 7 hours studying the scriptures every day. Because he's just dreaming, but he can't do that. He's dreaming about being able to do that, but he can't because he's a poor farmer, so he's got to work all the time to supply for him and his family. Well, being a scribe of the kingdom of heaven doesn't mean that all you do is sit down and read, but it means that this is a big part of your life. I love the fact that my job is also something I'm passionate about. I can't believe, and some of you are going to say, yeah, I can't believe we pay you to do this too. But I can't believe that I get paid to study my Bible and share it with you guys. It's a great joy to me. It really is a delight that I am able to do that, and that a big part of my job is studying the scriptures to be able to teach it to other people. Not everybody's got that aspect to their life, so you have jobs you've got to be doing, which is fine. That doesn't mean that one is better than the other. It just means that's where God's called you to be, right? But all of us are called to be studying this book, to be reading it and learning what God is like, and to be learning how to put it into practice as we studied in Sunday school this morning. Don't be a forgetful hearer. That's a command to everybody, which means we've all got to be hearing. Not just on Sundays, but I hope that in your own personal time, you are setting aside time to read this book, to pray over it, and ask God to enlighten your understanding into what it says and how it is applied to your life, so that you can be a student, a scribe of the kingdom. Well, every scribe of the kingdom who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like the master of a house. I like this word. It's a lot of fun because it literally means a house despot. A house despot is a master of a house. We love despotism as a form of government, don't we? But how many of you like tyranny? Nobody's raising their hand. Nobody wants to be tyrannized? You don't want to be ruled over by an absolute monarch? I'm going to tell you, you got to be careful with this answer. How many of you want to be ruled over by an absolute monarch? You will be when Christ rules, right? Oh, I see where you're going with this, Pastor. You tricked us. We thought you were talking about current governments. Yeah, I know. It was a bit of a foul play, right? We understand, though, that Jesus is not going to ask our opinion in administering the kingdom, right? There won't be votes. His word is law. He's going to rule with an iron fist. But it's okay because he's good. That's the trouble with monarchy down here on this world, is we put monarchs in power that are sinners. But when Jesus rules his kingdom, he'll be a good, absolute despot. Well, this word, absolute despot, the despot of the house, he's the ruler of the house. He was in charge of caring for everybody under him. That would include his wife and his children, and if there were servants, it would include them and their wives and their children. So he had a pretty big responsibility. And in order to care for them, he would go to his treasury, which he would have a room where all of the necessaries were stored. Whether it was clothes, or whether it was food, or whether it was money, or whether it was weapons, whatever tools, whatever it was that was needed, he would have those things in his treasury. And when the need came up, he could go to that treasury, take the item out, and dispense it. He's dispensing blessing to people. He's dispensing care. And so when we are trained for the kingdom, it's like we're that master of the house, and we can go to our treasury and take out treasures. And we can give them to the people that need them. Whether they're old or new, not the people, the treasure. Because a master of a house would have to have things in his house that were old and that were new, some things that had been in there a long time and had been sitting and waiting for the proper time. And some things maybe that he just got in and all of a sudden he's, hi, this is perfect, I have it now, I need it. Well, the point that he's making is, you're a scribe of the kingdom, why? So that you can be a blessing to other people. You tripped over this treasure in the field. You've sold everything to acquire it. Now what does God want you to do with it? It's mine. Get away. Or does he want you to say, I want to show you something. I want to tell you about somebody. It's a treasure that's meant to be shared. We are like the masters of the house who can go out of that treasury. Because we've been studying this book, we know what God is like, we know what his son is like, we know what Jesus has done for us, we know what the word commands us to do day by day, and people need us to tell them, and they need us to show them. So you take that person under your wing that's wrestling with life, and you say, let me show you how to do this. Let me tell you, young man, what it's like to be a godly dad. Let me show you how to be a godly wife and a godly mother. Let me show you how to work in this job according to God's principles. And we dispense those treasures. He gives us these four parables to tell us mysteries of the kingdom. And he's told us the kingdom's hidden. Not everybody sees it. But you've seen it. He tells us it's costly. You want to embrace this kingdom? It is going to cost you. Not that salvation costs you money, but you will have to die to yourself. He's going to purify this kingdom from all the things that make it look like it's not quite what it should be. And he wants us to be the ministers of his blessing. As Paul talked in Corinthians, we carry this treasure in earthen jars. You don't normally put valuable treasures in pots of clay, but that's exactly what God has done. We're broken. We're cracked pots, aren't we? We're earthen vessels. On the outside, we don't always look too good. But God has deposited within us something invaluable, something that's priceless. And he wants to use us to dispense that blessing to people around you.